I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Jackson Davies is a Canadian actor who starred as Constable John Constable for 16 seasons of The Beachcombers. So begins his bio on the new book he's co-authored from Harbor Publishing, Bruno and the Beach, The Beachcombers at 40. 40 years ago, Canada's longest-running television drama debuted. This new book is a marvelous way to look back, filled with wonderful photographs and anecdotes about the series, its stars, and its popularity and legacy when it ran on the CBC from 1972 to 1990. In this book, we remember Bruno Gerussi, who was the star of the show, the supporting cast, Robert Clothier, Pat John, and Ray Brown, and, of course, Mr. Davies. We get a sense of what it was like backstage behind the cameras of the show that was set in Gibson's British Columbia, where Gerussi's Nick worked as a salvager of logs. It was also groundbreaking in its First Nations content. Jackson Davies joins me now. He's an award-winning actor and one of only two honorary sergeants in the RCMP. He's a member of the BC Entertainment Hall of Fame and is an instructor at Capilano University's Theater Department, where he teaches acting for the stage and screen. The book was co-authored with the late Mark Strange, who co-created the show, and its foreword was written by Michael J. Fox. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Jackson Davies. Mr. Davies, good morning.
Mr. Davies, boy, I guess I sound old, but after a show that's been on the air for like 40 years, maybe I am.
Yeah, no, you know, you're not that old, are you?
Well, no, I'm not. I'm sure I was very young when I did the show.
Yeah, you were like 10, right?
Yeah, that's right, yes. Yeah. And now I'm an honorary RCMP. It's great. But with no pension. They made very clear when they gave me the badge, no pension.
So what is that? What are the benefits of being an honorary sergeant?
Well, you know, I have to admit, I'll be honest with you, there's been the occasional time where I've been stopped, not that I speed or whatever, and I'll be recognized by a fellow member, and they're very polite and nice to me.
Ah, there you go. Right. So for people that didn't see the show, because people are listening to us on this website, maybe from a different country, even though the Beachcombers played in other countries, or they're my age, who, you know, I'm 30, so I'm a little too young to watch the show, but I mean, I grew up watching it. For those that didn't see the show, though, what was the premise? I mean, was it Nick? He was a salvager.
Yeah, it's very funny. I mean, you explain the premise, and I have one time, I think, down in Los Angeles, I'm trying to explain the premise to a Hollywood producer, and I said, okay, so it's about this guy who goes out in a boat, and he's got a First Nations partner, and they collect logs for a living.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's usually a pause after that as they look and they went, it ran how long? Well, you know, it's basically about small town Canada and the quirky characters. I grew up in a small town in central Alberta called Wetaskiwin, and we had characters, the guys that would hang out at, you know, the coffee shops and things like that. And this is what it was. It was kind of quirky, a little bit cheesy, and very kind of eclectic. And the neat part about it is that people did kind of relate to it from this. I don't know, maybe big city didn't relate to it as much as small cities, but it was a kind of a little snapshot of this small town in Canada from, you know, from 1971 when we started filming it right till 1990. So that, you know, that 19 years in the life of a small town community was kind of captured. It was kind of like a dramatic documentary.
Yeah, and Gibson's, I mean, really was a character in the show, wasn't it?
And it still is a character.
Yeah.
That's the neat thing about it is. The neat thing about Gibson's is that it's not on an island, but it's on the mainland, but you have to get to it by a ferry, so it may as well be in an island. So it is a little bit remote, you know. You know, the idea that after 8 o'clock at night, you're not going to be able to get off that little area was I think, lends a lot to the personality of the people that are there.
Yeah, and then people think that you live there, don't they?
Oh yeah, no. Me, of course. They, you know, I in midlife crisis got the motorcycle, and I tend to go for drives and stuff. And when I go up to Gibson's, everyone just assumes I should live there.
Yeah.
And we did, you know, mostly for the season, which would be about 4 or 5 months, closer to 4 or 5 months that we would live up there. And I was there last week, and I still have it's a wonderful trip. You take that trip from ferry from Horseshoe Bay to Langdale. And it's some of the most gorgeous scenery in the world, and it's I never tire of that trip.
Yeah, and what it is today, can some of it be, brought back to the show? I mean, did the show have a part in shaping what this?
Well, that's interesting.
Today?
You know, I don't know. I don't, you know, I mean, I think at first they weren't all that wild about us being there because people tended to go in that area not wanting the big city, not wanting the attention. Yeah. And we brought that attention to them from all around the world. And then they learned to kind of appreciate the idea about, well, yeah, they always say about, you know, they're traveling around the world and they say they're from Canada, but when they say they're from Gibson's, people went, the Beachcombers?
Yeah.
So, you know, I think, like a lot of things in life, maybe you appreciate it a bit more when it's gone.
Yeah, but there were times when you guys were shooting there that they'd throw stuff at you guys, right?
Well, it was, you know, I think it was a small group of people that didn't want us to be there, and actually a small group of people that kind of figured out how to win from that. When we'd be filming down by the marina, I'm sure some of the guys in the fishing boats would start up their sanders and their power pumps, so we'd have to send a case of beer over to quiet them up, and it seemed to work. They had that figured out quite well.
Now, Mark Strange co-created the show, and he's your co-author on this book. He died earlier this year?
Yeah, Mark co-created the series with his wife at the time, Lynn Susan Strange, and fabulous writers that both of them we chatted about doing this book a couple of times, and I knew Mark wasn't well, but and he certainly hung in there until he finished his section of it, and that was kind of a little bit bittersweet. You always, when you're in these things, writing a book took us over a year, plus the memories obviously go back a lot farther with Mark and I, but I'm glad we were able to finish something. He's a great writer. He's a great fiction writer. He's won all sorts of national and international awards. So it was just an honor for me to be in the same pages with him.
Yeah, no, he and L.S., that's his wife, at the time, right? They were married?
Yeah.
Yeah, and so they actually left the show before it went to air, right?
Yeah, you know, they kind of created the series with Phil Keatley. And they had some, some differences, creative differences with the CBC and left the series, you're right, just before the show went on air. And then they came back about 7 or 8 years later and were in it mostly to the end, yeah.
Yeah. Now, the CBC doesn't come off too well in the book.
Well, I tried not to be, and we tried not to be too mean to them. And honestly, when you think of it, without the CBC, there wouldn't have been the Beachcombers. So I guess we can't be too mean to them. But it's seems to be a little bit of a history with any time that someone tries to do a series with CBC. Sometimes it doesn't end well.
Yeah.
And we had our differences, and a lot to do, I think, with is that we are out here in Gibson's and on the West Coast, and still the power base of CBC is Toronto, and it's a long way to have to watch a series and have control over it, and that probably the distance of this country added a lot to that, I think.
So they did understand us, say?
Well, you know, I did hear the great story after I actually finished the book that I was talking to someone at CBC in Vancouver, and they said they're after 3 or 4 years when the series was doing so well, they actually Toronto did mention that they would like to move the series to Lake Ontario, which doesn't quite work, but, you know, maybe we'd be a little closer then.
Yeah. Now, Bruno, he didn't like dealing with Toronto, and there's stories in the book about him going there. I guess he had to go there once a year or whatever for meetings and just being a terror to them.
Well, he liked Toronto, but I think it was, and he's always been that way. He's the kind of person that kind of would kind of, anytime there was anyone who was a kind of in a position of authority, he would always try to question it. That was him. That was just the type of person he was. And he would have all sorts of things. And you know, the show wasn't, you know, in the end wasn't, when they told him he was going to do this show, he had visions of, you know, having a co-star who was a young lady. There'd be a bit of a love interest. He would be the star. And then it turned into a different direction. You know, CBC decided they didn't want, that would be probably, they didn't want any sexual tension on the show. So his so-called love interest became a grandmother. Mm-hmm. And then once Robert was introduced to the show as Relic, Bruno had to be the straight man, and even though any time that I worked with him, I never heard him. You know, I mean, he was always very, very professional, and doing the series. But I think he is, I remember talking to him about how he didn't, you know, he was upset and wanted to leave the series. But you know, we kept coming back. We kept coming back to doing it because in the end we loved doing it.
Yeah, and you guys got along, right?
Oh yeah, I got along quite well with Bruno. Again, excuse me. You know, he's he was a stage actor, actor worked at Stratford, and actually in theaters all around the world. And I had done a lot of theater too, so I think that had a little bit of respect in his book. Plus, I don't take things too seriously, and I would constantly be trying to break him up or give him a bit of a rough time. And he kind of appreciated me there, trying to keep the set kind of light.
Yeah, but the relationship with Robert Clothier, who played Relic, it was professional but not personal, right?
No, professional would be, and they were both fine actors, and they were wonderful to work with, and they enjoyed working with each other. They would actually, it was a bit of a competition sometime, and they enjoyed that. Two good actors like that, they mm-hmm. like that sort of thing. But I guess maybe they didn't have a lot in common after we would wrap during the day.
Well, what did Bruno think of the role? I mean, you said that that he, he wanted to leave at some point, but the role really defined him, didn't it? Did he find that sort of a negative in the end?
Well, no, I think Bruno enjoyed being a star, and I think it was the right time in Canada because any of the stars we had were probably sports figures. There wasn't too many TV stars who actually stayed in the country and made a career here. I mean, it was wonderful for me to be working with these guys who, in fact, did stay in their country and became major stars. And I've said this before, there was if there was an article in the paper when I was researching the book, all it had to say is Bruno, and you knew who it was. And so I certainly enjoyed that. He enjoyed the notoriety. He certainly enjoyed, the things that came with it.
Now, that house with the sunken dinner table, where was that? That was in Gibson's?
That's right on the top. If you go to Gibson's and right by Molly's Reach, if you look up and a little bit to the left, you will see this this hill that's in Gibson's, and Bruno's house is right on the top. And it started out a little smaller, and then it became a little larger. He built a log house section part of it, and we called it Fort Jerusi because we'd look up to the hill, and Bruno loved the idea that it had about a 360-degree view. So
it's a beautiful house.
It was a beautiful house.
Yeah.
And Bruno was an artist. It's funny that both Robert and Bruno were fairly good artists outside of their work. Bruno loved to carve wood, and he would he'd do wonderful carvings, and the house had wonderful pieces of art built into it. He had a carver do the door, and wonderful little fences and at the back, and all carved by First Nations and artists as well as other artists. And it was a very neat place to be. Bruno had a great style about him. I mean, his clothes were great, and parts of the house were just magic.
Now, he died in 95, is that correct?
Yeah, just 5 years after we stopped the series.
Yeah, did you guys meet up and things like that after the show ended?
Yeah, we both at that time lived in West Van, so we would meet a lot. We would grab a coffee, and when I was just building a house, I think in 92, and he came over and gave some suggestions, because his dad was built stone walls, so... We would see each other, and we'd maybe go and grab a golf game or something like that. But it was a bit of a shock.
Yeah, it was a sudden death, right?
Yes, it was. Yeah.
Other than Sergeant Preston of the Yukon, Constable is probably the most recognizable Mountie in Canadian popular culture. How did you come to that role? I guess you weren't there from the beginning. You in 72, right? You
were no, later? I came in later, about 74, early 74. I may have auditioned in 73, but in 74. No, it was just one of those things, those fate things that happen in life where you. And the part, the original part, I don't even think even had any lines. I think I was just supposed to drive the police car away. Uh-huh. But my audition really boiled down to, they say, can you grow a mustache? And what size are you? And I didn't realize that at that time that the RCMP actually kept a pretty strict code on the number of RCMP uniforms that could be made that would be for use outside of the RCMP. They
right.
kept track of everything that was any film set, and so they would only allow certain many made every year, and they're very expensive too. They were like $1,600 or $1,800.
Yeah.
And the CBC had one that they thought they would fit me. So it was basically, I fit the part in more ways than one. Even though the sleeves were a little short on the uniform for the first year or two, I kept my arms tucked very close to my side.
Yeah. Well, why do you think the show did so well?
Oh, it's. combination of things, and because of this book, you know, you chat to a lot more people, and that obviously there's a social media aspect that we never had when we did this series. But I think it was a combination of it was the right time. In Canada, there wasn't too many Canadian dramas on that particular time. I mean, heck, the Thursday before, we'd just beaten Russia in the Summit series. I think the idea of a family with the television sitting around watching on a Sunday night, a family thing, you know, you'd have a family supper on a Sunday night, you'd watch, maybe watch Disney, which certainly helped, and then they would watch Beachcombers. As someone said, the three B's, Beachcomber, Bath, and Bed. And we would probably go through generations, I guess, of kids, because we'd get the kids for 4 or 5 years or something, and then maybe they would grow older. Then we'd get a new group that would be there for 3 or 4 years, and we'd get the parents. And I know the people who talk to me every day about it, they say the same thing, is that it just reminds them now why it's still successful, or why it's why the book is doing so well, is that it reminds them of that time of where family and the shows were pretty harmless. And you could watch, maybe you had the one TV in the house, and you would watch a show as a family. And I'm trying to think of one now that would be equivalent. I mean, I guess it would be The Simpsons. Isn't that scary?
Now, at the time that you guys were all doing the show, did you consciously think that you were capturing, say, a sort of visual time capsule?
No.
Of the time, the place, et cetera? No?
No. And it is interesting. I do a lot of theater, and that's immediate. You know, you do a show, you rehearse it, you do it in front of an audience, you get the instant response, and that's a wonderful experience. With this, I didn't know. I was pretty young when I, again, 23, 24 when I started. Sure, you'd know that someone would tell you that 2 or 3 million people watched it. You have kind of, unless someone stopped you on the street, but, you know, being Canadians, we're pretty kind that way. We don't tend to bother people. But I think if we would have been doing it now with the social media aspect of it, we would have been feeling a little bit more connection with the audience, and that's I guess the nature of the beast and how things have changed that way. But honestly, I didn't think, and all around the world, it's I mentioned to someone else too that I think Molly's Reach is probably the most recognizable BC building in the world.
Yeah.
And you never think of these things when you're doing those when you're just dressing up and pretending you're somebody else.
Now Ray Brown, she played Molly on the show. The end for her it seems sad. Her husband and son had died, and she was pretty much alone, right?
Yeah, she was, and I don't know if she had much family. I know that. She was pretty much alone. I think I got an email from someone who said that they were like a second cousin, but she didn't. You know, there were some neighbors who were taking care of her near the end, and it's that was rather sad. And Ray, after she left the series right a couple of years before it ended, like 4 years before, and she just wanted to kind of just go away quietly, I guess.
She lived in Vancouver?
Yeah, she did in Burnaby, yeah.
Some of the others, like Pat John, he's still around, right?
Yeah, I talked to Pat, who played Jesse in the show. He lives in Seashell area and fishes a bit and clams, which I guess would qualify for being a beachcomber again, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And Charlene Alec, who played Sarah, the young girl, I talked to her. She's very involved in First Nations issues on the North Shore, and some of the younger guys who came in the last 2 or 3 years, I chat to them a lot too, as well as Bobby Park, who played Huey. Mm-hmm. He lives fairly close to where I live, and we grab a coffee every once in a while and tell some lies.
and just as many people that we saw on the screen, there were more off screen, and you still keep in touch with the crew and the sort?
Yeah, you can't go to a film production in BC and not meet someone who was a part of the Beachcomber crew. I mean, that was the basic training ground for Hollywood North. How that we learned how to do things on the fly, and we basically got a chance to do 23 episodes a year. So these guys got they've got a chance to become a really tight crew, and now most of them have gone on, and a lot of them have gone on writing, winning Emmys in the States as writers and directors and cinematographers as well that got their start on Beachcomber.
Yeah, didn't the woman that you marry on the show, didn't she go on to
Moira Raleigh? Yeah, she was a great actress, and probably one of the problems with her career is she was too good looking and talented, because every time that she would be a part of an American show here, that I'm sure the star would go, get that lady off the set. You know, we had a great time working together, and she's very bright. She's a fabulous singer and dancer as well, one of those triple threats. And I didn't know she was an interesting writer, too. And my son actually said, you know, there's a great series called Breaking Bad. You should watch it. And I went, Moira Wally, she's one of the executive producers and the head writers, the showrunners on the show. So, again, that's quirky. Yeah. Maybe some of those characters she got out of Beachcombers, I don't know.
Is it true that Bruno couldn't swim?
He couldn't swim in the ocean. He couldn't swim a stroke.
Really?
And that would add a little trickiness. But, you know, but he still would have the courage to walk along those logs, which isn't, when I take a look at some of the shows we did, I'm going, oh my God, we did those things without stunt people and then all sorts of things that at that time we just did it. And he would be around on there, but we'd make sure, and we actually wrote it into the show that he couldn't swim as well. That was to be a part of things, but if you can't swim, and my mother can't swim, and she has actual fear of water, and Bruno was, I don't know if he had a fear, but whatever it was, he did get over it, but still couldn't swim.
Now, I'm sure people ask you, especially since the book came out, that why isn't the show on DVD? Is there a move to get that on DVD?
Well, you know, I've tried for the last, 15 years or so, and I don't know. There's 360 episodes, and only 60 of those have ever been really even repeated and stripped. So there's been 300 that really haven't been on the air since 1990. Yeah. Even the final show we did was only played once. I guess in CBC's defense, if I could say that, I guess maybe they just don't think, they just don't want to do it. You know, is it a little bit of work? Yeah, probably having to clear some of the rights, but I guess it's their choice. They just don't want to do it.
Yeah. Now, did you have copies for yourself, Seth?
Well, a couple of the actors, parents and things like that over the years had recorded the VHS. So I've got some old copies of VHS, so I got a chance to take a look at them when I was doing some research from the book. And this morning, someone at CBC, I had forgotten, there was a 10th anniversary in 1982, which we did a TV show, which only showed in BC, which was kind of funny. And actually, they sent it to me, and I'd forgotten about doing it, and it was a great little show for the 10th anniversary. It was nice to see us all, you know, young and charging away and realizing that we're only halfway there at that particular time. And to take a look at some of those things is a treat. And also, I co-produced a documentary in 2002, with CBC and Force 4, and it was a great documentary, too, and I watched that the other day, and unfortunately, again, that's only been played that one time. Yeah. And I take a look at this and thinking that it would be nice to be able to get these things out for the fans. I get emails every day from all across the world wanting DVDs, especially around Christmas time. So that's maybe once I've got this book all finished and things, maybe that's what I will try to work on that over this next couple of months to see if I can get something happening.
Yeah, well, and until the DVDs come out, they can read this book, buy this book, and read it and look back. There's great photos in it.
Yeah, we were very lucky with the photos because Roy Lukow, who was our director of photography, always had a camera with him. So the neat thing is the pictures, if you notice, aren't stage pictures. You know, most of them are behind the scenes and, you know, the curtains. So it's of the crew and the actors and the beauty that is Gibson's. No, we had a great response from the book. It's been doing really well, and it's a nice thing that happens too.
Yeah, do you teach full time at CAP?
Mostly, yeah. I do about three quarter time at the film for the acting, for the stage and screen and thing, which I'm enjoying as much. And I still do some. I try to do theater every couple of years, do a stage show, and if some film comes along that's interesting, I'll find time to do that. But I'm basically writing a couple of TV series now too. So I'm finding that in the end, if you really want something great, you have to write it for yourself.
Yeah. Now, in the course of your teaching at Capilano University, are you seeing talented performers from this part of the world?
Absolutely. Yeah. You're seeing some. And it's interesting that there's a lot more younger, guys that are coming into the business now. I guess they assume, and used to be in theater schools or anything, there'd be, be about 70% or 80% women. But now that's kind of changed with, I guess, the idea that it's okay to be, to be an actor. And, and there's some really talented kids that are coming along. And one of my courses that I teach is basically, surviving in this business. And you just really, certainly in Canada anyways, it's very difficult to be just an actor. And so you've got to be able to write. You've got to be able to produce. You've got to be able to know how to shoot something and edit something, because the technology is changing that whole distribution.
Now, you mentioned going back to the stage from time to time. I remember I saw you in The Producers.
Oh, yeah.
You were great in that.
I had so much fun doing that stage show. I hadn't done a musical in about 20 years, and I just loved doing that show every night. I have a huge appreciation for people who can sing. I kind of faked the singing and dancing, but it was just a treat to do. I love the theater.
Yeah, Haben Sie gehört das Deutsche Band, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
Jackson, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you today. Congratulations on this book. It's a really fun book, and continued good luck with it.
And thanks for doing this. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. The book is called Bruno and the Beach, The Beachcombers at 40 by Mark Strange and Jackson Davies. Jackson Davies joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plato.